everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm here today with my friend, Rob Henderson. He is the author of Troubled. What's the rest of the title? It's got a subtitle, right?
Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family, and social class.
Yeah, that's a good subtitle. It's a U.S. News and World Report bestseller.
Is that USA right? Today. USA Today bestseller.
USA Today. Okay, and so congratulations.
Thank you.
On your success. It's well-deserved. You've been, you eventually found a place to have a book launch event.
Yeah, we had a book launch event in New York. So February 20th was the book launch date. And yeah, the initial plan was to do it in a bookstore somewhere in New York and then follow on to San Francisco and then go out to LA. And we contacted more than a dozen bookstores in those three cities, and none of them were interested. And so I wrote this Substack post documenting this surprising difficulty that I had. And Jesse Singel contacted me. And so we did an event at the Village Underground, which it's a comedy club. So it was not, it was kind of an odd venue to do a book launch, but it ended up being fine. You know, it was kind of intimate, the setting. We packed like 170 people into this sort of underground cellar. And then it was just me and Jesse on this small stage. It ended up being a lot of fun. I did some other events too. I talked at AEI, did an event, at these VC offices out in SF. So, you know, these were kind of like makeshift last minute kind of, invitations from readers and from fans and people who, wanted to see me. And it was really nice to see that, to get the support, to do these public events for the book.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, it was really weird because you said that, like, I don't know, I wouldn't have predicted this beforehand, that the bookstores would have been like this. I mean, maybe, you know, if it was like they had some kind of like, it was like tough competition to get into bookstores. But from what you said in your Substack piece, it's not like you could have 300 Twitter followers and you could have like events on these things.
It's really interesting. Yeah. Because I looked at the schedules and the events pages of these bookstores wondering, like, you know, do they host events? Who are they inviting? And yeah, you know, these were kind of small time authors. A lot of them were, you know, they had positions at some legacy media outlet, even though they didn't have very many followers. Some of them, they were authors and they were getting a lot of kind of buzz in legacy media, but they themselves, you know, the books didn't seem to be particularly successful. And, you know, I thought my book was the kind of like my following and yours too. Like we would like, you know, if you're, I don't know, if you're someone Britney Spears just wrote a memoir, she's not going to talk at a bookstore, right? Like she's just way too famous. Yeah. And if you're the kind of author who only has, you know, a couple hundred followers on Twitter, like is anyone really going to show up for your event? But if you're someone with, you know, in the tens of thousands of followers, you can get a couple dozen, maybe 100 on a good day to show up at a bookstore. Yeah. And that seems like the ideal kind of author you would want if you run like a sort of big, sort of swanky upscale bookstore, is to get a few dozen people in and they'll buy some coffee and browse the shelves and you'll make some money that day. I got a variety of different, you know, I spoke to authors and people in the business and asked like, what do you think's going on here? Some of them thought it was political. Some of them thought it's because I'm sort of independent because I'm on Substack and not at a legacy media outlet. Others suggested it was my affiliations, like, you know, Jordan Peterson blurred my book, J.D. Vance blurred my book. And a lot of the people who run bookstores are kind of, they're not very friendly to people who are sort of right of center. Even though the book itself is apolitical, I thought, it was endorsed by people who people who run the bookstores don't really like very much. So there's a variety of possibilities.
I would have thought that they would be, they wanted to make money. I thought that's what people were into bookstores for, but maybe people are into books. Did you try like, were there like Barnes and Nobles? Well, what kind of bookstores were you trying?
No. This was like the Strand in New York and PNT Knitwear in SF. These are like sort of upscale, like these have like large venues where they could like fit like a few dozen people in like an author book talk setting. Not like a Barnes and Noble, more so like places that do author events. Like, that's what, you know, that's one of the reasons why they exist.
So these are very, like, elite sort of. So I'm thinking, yeah, if, like, if you tried, like, a Barnes & Noble, like, I think you probably would have had a better chance, right? Like, they probably.
Yeah, like, but I don't know. It would have been weird, though, because, like, I think, like, the Barnes & Noble is probably too small. I mean, maybe there are, like, the really. Are there still, like, huge Barnes & Nobles? I remember when I was a kid, but, like.
Yeah, aren't they all huge? I don't know.
I've popped into some Barnes & Nobles recently, and they seem to be smaller than they used to be.
There are ones in malls that are really large. They can have hundreds of.
Okay.
They can have probably
100 people. Could they fit like a seated event? I don't know, maybe. It was a little bit of a surprise there. Like, I thought that was the goal too, was to make money. But there was a really interesting post in Persuasion. Right around the time my book came out, I can't remember the author's name. She's a good author. She's a good writer. And she wrote this piece basically saying that, like, because everyone buys their books on Amazon now or online, bookstores have sort of, they've become sort of more overtly political, interestingly. Mm. And so they have to sort of, if you want to get people to actually go to a store and buy a book there, you have to sort of pander to their interests and to their, you have to flatter their political leanings. And so, you know, if you run an upscale bookstore, you know, you're going to want to not invite people who would deter customers or who you wouldn't want to lose your regulars, right? And so they're willing to sort of, even though on that day they make a lot of money because they have, you know, they might do an event with Richard Hanania or Rob Henderson, in the long run, they may actually do damage to themselves. And so they just don't want to risk it. And they only do events with sort of approved authors that their regular customers would like.
Yeah, they don't want your kind around. Like, you're good. Yeah, if it was like, I don't know, like Lil Wayne wanted to do a book event there. I don't know. It's like you're the wrong clientele for that bookstore. Yeah, that makes sense. But I mean, you don't need them. I mean, that's like, it's sort of a representative. It's a microcosm of everything else that's going on, because in the end, you don't actually need them. You have a big enough audience, and you could have an event if you want, and people could show up, and people could still get your book, and it still can sell a lot. So that's great.
Exactly. And the book's doing fine. Like, it was more of, it wasn't for like the success of the book. It was more so like for my own interest. Like, I thought it would be cool to do an event at a bookstore. Mm-hmm. And like, ultimately, like, the events I ended up doing were kind of cooler anyway. Like, doing it at a comedy club was a cool thing. But, in the moment I was really, irritated at how things, were developing. But yeah, I mean, everyone buys, I can't remember the last time, like, I went into a bookstore in order to search. I've like browsed bookstores. I like browsing bookstores, and I'll buy a book that way. But like, if I'm looking for a book, you know, if I'm pre-ordering your book or whoever's book, I'll just get it online. And that's how most people get their books now.
Yeah. It's good for like kids' books. If you could go in the, like, you could look around and see the kind of like pop-ups and pictures and nice coffee table books, and you can't really do that online. So they still have a benefit. But you're right. Bookstores are, it seems like if you own a high-end bookstore in New York City, it seems like you're doing it for, you know, you're creating, it's like a cultural environment. It's like, you know.
Yeah. You're kind of operating at a loss in a way. Like, I don't actually know, but like, I'm assuming they're not actually earning that much, but you're sort of, you're right. You're creating a space for people to interact and to meet and to create that sort of
There was a New York Times article about like France and like Paris, actually the city of Paris, and like how they have like government just owns like a lot of the downtown buildings, and they want like a certain kind of culture. So like, they don't just sell it to like Chipotle or the highest bidder or whatever. And so like, they're like, oh, there's a feminist bookstore in like the middle of Paris, downtown Paris. Like, that's not making enough money to survive in downtown Paris under like a free market. But like, the government's like, oh, this is the kind of business we want. And I figure that a lot of the bookstores are probably people like that who are just doing it for the love of the game. Leftist, high prestige, low pay kind of professions.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. High prestige, low pay. Yeah. If you run an independent boutique sort of upscale bookstore, you're probably not getting paid much, but you do get to sort of control who gets status conferred upon them by the kind of metropolitan, educated, upper middle class.
Yeah. So this book, one of the things I noticed is you're not an emotional writer. It's like, there's a lot of things that are sort of like emotionally heavy. Like, you could have said like, this made me cry and made me wonder about my place in the universe. And like, there's a little bit of that, but it's very like, not like as emotional as you would expect given the story. Was that like conscious, or was that, is this just like how you're comfortable writing, or you know, what's the sort of the reasoning behind that?
I mean, I write the way I write. It wasn't, you know, like I have heard that from other people. I mean, I do note in there, like there are times when I get really upset or I feel despair, and I write about, you know, there was a time, you know, there were times where I cried and I write about those, but you know, the book is, I wasn't, yeah, that's like, that's just how I write. You know, I was trying to communicate just sort of the experience, the, you know, the memories that I had. And I wasn't that emotional anyway. Like I could, like I had some anger issues when I was younger, but generally speaking, like I just was not like a particularly neurotic or emotional person as a kid. And so I thought I, you know, I just sort of conveyed that through the writing. But it was not a conscious or strategic way to communicate. That's just how I write things.
Yeah. And so you're, yeah, that's your, yeah. And so it seems like you sort of have like an allergy towards like emotional self-pity victimization. This sort of seems like it would explain your story, the way you understand your own story and sort of your politics and like social views, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like, the kind of woe is me, you know, like, I mean, it's so funny. I think like when people read the synopsis of my book or they hear, you know, about it or something, they assume that's the kind of book it's going to be. But it's really not, you know, but like, that's, you know, that's how it's sort of positioned. That's sort of how it's marketed in that vein of like that kind of coming of age memoir, this sort of tough luck story or whatever. But you know, when people actually read the book, I think people are surprised that I don't dwell too much on like, you know, the subjective internal feelings of hardship or something. One reason is because like, you know, when you grew up the way that I did, like it's not unusual to you. This was actually something that I spoke with my editors about. Like they wanted me to like bring in a bit more emotion, a bit more of, you know, like, well, what were you really feeling? And you need to, because the readers aren't going to be familiar with this and you're going to have to tell them. And, you know, I basically had to tell, you know, my response to them was, for me, it wasn't unusual. Like, I'm not looking at this from the perspective of some, you know, sort of comfortable college educated person. Like, for me, in that moment, as a little kid or whatever, like, that's how every kid's life was. That was all around me. That was like everyday life. It was not particularly unique. And I think actually, in a way, by writing the story in that way, it became more effective. The fact that I didn't dwell on the sort of peculiarity of my circumstance and instead just sort of told it in a matter-of-fact way, I think that ended up ultimately being more effective, even if that wasn't like the original intent.
Mm. Yeah. Do you ever think about, you know, I'm just as a person who is interested and thinks about heredity. You mentioned your birth mom's family. They were wealthy in Korea, right?
Yeah, my grandfather, my mother's father, he was sort of self-made, independently wealthy, where he was a police detective in Seoul and then started a fertilizer company and had grown wealthy and sent my mother to the U.S. to study. And so, yeah, I mean, of course, like, you know, and you know, I didn't want to, you know, this book isn't about, you know, the heredity or behavior genetics, but I do, you know, mention that. And I do sort of toward the end of the book describe how, you know, throughout the book, I note that I was clearly different than my friends in high school. I mentioned that I was the only one who enjoyed reading. I mentioned that I was the only one who placed into the advanced courses in my high school. I mentioned that I tested well on the ASVAB and then later the SAT despite like not really studying. And so, you know, all of those things, you know, like I could say like those are like maybe dog whistles for the hereditarians. But you know, I acknowledge that all of those things matter. But one thing that I hoped also I conveyed in the book was that you know, even if you're a smart person, and I know that like your own personal background, Richard, like even if you're a smart person and you're academically inclined and you're a curious person, like that's necessary, but not sufficient to do well academically. Like you still have to like have a little bit of structure, some guidance, some mentorship. And if those things are not in place, you can have a very bright kid who just like falls in with, you know, his peer group and indulges his appetites and his impulses. And, you know, I was still doing a lot of the same things that all my friends were doing. And in part, that was because I lacked any kind of structure for basically my entire childhood.
Yeah. Your mom is like interesting, right?
Because which mom? My adoptive mom or my
all of them. All of them. But no, I was thinking of I was thinking about the biological mom because it's an interesting story, right? She comes to America. She seems to go crazy, right? She seemed to her Korean family must have been shocked. I mean, this is what the 2000s. A police detective?
No. This was the late 80s. I was born in 89.
You were born in 89.
The end of 89. So I was born in the end of 89. So this was mid late 80s when she was doing all this.
I knew that. Just stupid. So this was Korea was a dictatorship when he was a police detective. It wasn't even any kind of modern democracy yet. I mean, his fertility rate was still, 5 or 6 or 7 or something like that. And Koreans are conservative today and they don't go out and, have out of wedlock births or anything. But in the 1980s, you could just imagine, right?
Yeah.
And so she was like, What was she doing in America? She was studying something, right?
Yeah. I don't know what she was studying. So all of this information I later got from my adoptive mom. So when I left home, she gave me this file full of documents and information from my case in social care. And so it was full of information from social workers, caseworkers, forensic psychologists, teachers. And so I have these sort of sparse notes from my caseworker, and it said, she came to the U.S. as a young woman to study and very quickly started to do drugs and hang out with whatever, people, vagrants and whoever else. I can imagine that's kind of the horror story, right? And I've heard stories like this before, interestingly, of people sending their kids off, sons or daughters, off to America. And then the son or daughter, usually they don't go to the extent that my mom did, where they literally just sort of lose control and spiral out and start having kids out of wedlock and so on. But they drop out of college and fall in with some quasi hippie group or join some kind of weird political movement and then not graduate and fulfill the expectations of their parents. America is a very free country, which is, good and bad in its own way. And I think a lot of kids, especially immigrant kids, are especially if they're not immediately plugged into an ethnic enclave where they don't know people here already, that kind of liberating society can be very, it can be dangerous, I think, for some people, especially if you're sort of inclined to, hedonism.
Especially for, to go away somewhere by yourself is a very... it's a very sort of unnatural thing. And then for women, how often has that happened in human history? Women have gone off or prehistory have gone off and just, lived in a completely new culture. I mean, you can imagine that could be, I don't know, I've seen foreign students, even less extreme cases, but they often end up lonely. I mean, it is a sort of lonely existence. Even I did a study abroad in Russia and I was with American students. And even that was sort of lonely. I mean, you just feel it just feels like you can't talk to normal people the way that you would, right? You can't talk to someone at the store and all your family, your friends, nobody is around. So it's sort of a crazy, what was she studying, by the way, your mom?
I don't know what she was studying. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I just had this conversation a couple of weeks ago with this older American woman. She's in her 50s now, but she was telling me how, so she's American, but when she was in college and she went to Yale, I think her sophomore year or something, she went off to Italy her sophomore year to study for a semester in Italy. And then she just met an Italian mechanic and impulsively decided to marry him. And I think this was in the 80s or something. Yeah. And her parents, her rich parents, her parents were rich and, they send their daughter off to Italy. Suddenly she drops out, gets married to this random Italian mechanic. And they were furious at her. This kind of stuff can happen, right? If you're, kind of young and idealistic and, unprepared and things, weird things like that can happen. In my mom's case, it was just, even more,
And you think about the times of, LA I mean, late 80s, early 90s. I mean, what a time period. If she stuck around for the Rodney King riots, she would have known what side to be on, right? It was, she's hanging out with the ghetto.
Although I think, I don't know if she was like, I don't know if she would have, because, it's unclear because, like, we were in Westlake by the time I was placed into care. And, like, Westlake at that time in, well, this was the early 90s by this point because I was three. I mean, that was, like, a pretty, like, heavily immigrant population, like, mostly Hispanic. I think they had, like, a small sort of Filipino and some, like, Asian population there, too. But, like, So I went my whole adult life, or, like, my whole life, essentially, not really knowing anything about my father's side of the family. And then I took this 23andMe, discovered my dad was Mexican. And so, like, that was probably, you know, the kind of crowd she was hanging out with was, like, you know, the vatos and, like, the you know, sort of Filipino and Mexican sort of street gangs or people sort of affiliated with those groups. So, but, it was, like, that time in the 90s, man. I mean, there was one quote from my social worker that I found interesting where my mother was questioned by a forensic psychologist and they asked her, how many drugs she had done when she started to do them, basically questioning her about her drug use. And she basically, my mother's response was like, it's a psychedelic age. Like we can do whatever we want. Like why are you questioning me about this?
Does she come across as a philosophical kind of reflective person? Like from the book, I got the impression she was just a junkie, like completely like had no control. Like when you look at these forensic psychology reports, like, well, you know, it's a psychedelic age in this contemporary era.
I note that in the book that she said it was a psychedelic age. And I mean, she may have had sort of moments of clarity and moments of lucidity where she sounded, smart. Maybe she was smart, but, But apparently, so that wasn't her first run-in with law enforcement. And so, she was eventually deported back to South Korea. Apparently, she'd been arrested a couple of times before. And that was the last time I saw her.
Yeah, and nobody ever reached out to you. Like, do you know if even your grandparents in Korea, could they have not even known of your existence? Like,
It's possible. Yeah, it's possible they don't even know. I've never heard from her or from anyone in, on that side of my family. I mean, for all I know, they probably, they might have disowned her. I never heard from her again after that or my grandfather or anyone else.
Never curious, never wanted to sort of reach out to them and see if.
Not really. I mean, I'm not particularly interested. I mean, I don't really have like a strong desire. I mean, she's clearly was not in a good sort of mental state, not in a position to care for me. And, I'm like a naturally a vengeful person. And funny. I talked to Gad Saad the other day, and he asked me a really interesting question where he said, imagine that you saw your mom today and she was like, living like a horrible life, like, a horrible junkie on the margins of existence. Would you feel bad for her or would you feel happy because she treated you so horribly and therefore she deserves this life? And I paused for a second and I wasn't sure how to answer that, but I don't think I would go out of my way to help her. I just don't really feel, if someone is kind to me, then I will return that. But if not, and especially, to a small child, it's weird. Like when I see little kids today and I can imagine like a parent treating them in that way, it's just unthinkable to me. So I really don't feel any, connection to her at all.
Yeah. With my kids, my God, like it. I see them suffer. It's just the worst thing. And like to inflict that suffering, I can't even discipline them. I mean, I can't even tell them to stop doing stuff. I laugh. Yeah. I can't, I see them doing something bad. I laugh. I just cannot be angry. I cannot be upset. So I can imagine. Yeah. It's a, I just want to know the grandfather if I was you, like CSI fertilizer.
It's funny. I don't think it would be that hard to find.
Yeah. He was probably coming communist. I mean, he was probably, he was like, I talked to some guy, Uber driver from Korea, and he said he was in jail because he was like pro-communist when he, pro-North Korea when he was like in college. And so like, he was just trying to impress girls. And the government at the time would just round you up. And he said he was like tortured by the police and stuff. So I think part of their job would have probably like in the 80s and earlier would have probably been just to like clamp down on the communists. So that guy's probably like, you know, that guy's probably got a fascinating story.
Yeah, that's. Oh, but it's also. I mean, is he even alive at this point? I mean, yeah, I don't know. But you're. Yeah, I don't think if he were alive, I don't know how hard it would be to find him. You know, because like, how many fertilizer companies are there in Seoul? You know, like there can't be that many. It's probably not hard to track down
fertilizer companies in Seoul. I don't know. But there might be a lot. It's a huge one. I guess it's a really big one. Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Maybe.
I mean,
and he's. You might have an inheritance, man. You might have a Korean empire.
I think like maybe like 10 years ago that would have been interesting to me to just for like, you know, the money reason alone. But I think now I don't really need it. I've taken all the sort of genetic tests and like learned about all of the propensities and, you know, sort of you know, potential maladies and all that. Like, I have all the information, and I don't think I need to know.
Has a family, who has a biological family that I've known my whole life, and has they're from a different culture. So, like, if you met your family, they'd be Korean, they'd be different.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I'm not like them, and I'm like my mom. People who know my mom. But like me, if I was an Arabic woman from like, you know, from rural Jordan, I mean, if you can imagine such a thing, right? Mm-hmm. It would be like not intellectually curious, not free thinking in any way, but like personality. It's hard to describe. It's like there's a silliness, like a playfulness, like in the personality. And that is like people who know us will say it's like so uncanny. Right. Mm-hmm. But she like doesn't read books. It's not like that intellectual part of me just does not exist in my mom. Right. Mm-hmm. And so you see these little things where it's like there's this huge cultural gap. But you also have these similarities that just sort of make their way in. So it's a very sort of just seeing how heredity interacts, because most people don't get that. Most people, they're from the same culture. Right. And so like they probably felt closer to their relatives than I do because they probably are more similar. They're like, they were in the same culture and they have the same genes. Well, me, I have the same genes, but a completely different culture. And that's, yeah, that's actually fascinating. Mm-hmm. So you took the 23andMe. You know what? It pops up on the 23andMe when you do that. It says like, do you pick that option to like let relatives contact me or whatever it is?
I don't think so. I don't think I because I don't know if I wanted that. I didn't know if I wanted to be contacted.
Okay.
But now that you mention, I don't actually know if I clicked it or if I needed to. Like, I actually don't know. But if like I were contacted, I don't know how responsive I would be to it.
Yeah. I think you have to opt it in. But what they do is you could go to your 23andMe page and they'll be like, you know, if they also opted in, it'll be like, oh, here's a second cousin. And then they'll just, you know, they'll be able to message you or you'll be able to message them. And so a lot of people like, you know, find relatives that way. And it's a lot of people like it's impossible to like cucks. It's impossible to have a long term, like uncertain paternity now, even adoption, because all you have to do is join 23andMe and you'll soon be able to triangulate basically who your parents are, because a huge portion of the public is within these databases. I'm interested in your case, because if he's a low class Mexican, he might not have a lot of, you know, relatives who are actually in the 23andMe database. So it might actually be different in that case, but somebody related somehow, you know, will be found.
I don't know. Maybe I'll turn it on. I don't know. Do I want to meet like a second cousin? Like if I'm going to meet what a
vato, you made it, bro.
I know. Asking me for money or like, no. If I'm going to, like, I don't want to like risk being contacted by a second. Like if it's going to be someone from I'd rather it be like a sibling. I guess a first cousin maybe, but like someone who I would feel some kind of genetic kinship with. But it's just not that.
What if your dad ended up like, you know, like some kind of, you know, ghetto millionaire, like an Andrew Tate type or something?
That would be hilarious.
Both sides of the family are just, you know, ended up being successful and it worked out like that. That would be, that's interesting.
I mean, I don't know. I just... yeah, I'm not that, like, I'm interested in myself. Obviously, I took these tests. Like, I'm curious about myself and my inclinations and traits and everything. But, like, as far as family goes, I'm just, you know, I don't feel a strong desire to seek that out.
Yeah. I get it. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of awkward. I mean, it is awkward. I can imagine, like, it's not going to be, you know, like the most, and I'm not, it's not like I'm a guy who's like always like hanging out with my family or anything. Like, I get just like the idea of wanting to be yourself and focus on what you're interested in, live your life the way it is. But man, it's just a fascinating story. It's just such an unusual story. Are you the most like successful foster kid in America? Like, have you ever looked into like anyone else who's
No. There is at least one billionaire who was a foster kid. His name escapes me. He emailed me the other day. And yeah, apparently he'd read my book. And so, yeah, I mean, like, you know, as far as like, you know, I don't think I'm the most successful, but probably in like the top 1%, which isn't that hard to do because only 3% of kids from foster care even get a college degree. And so, you know, I'm probably in the top 1%, maybe even the top 0.1%. But yeah, there aren't, you know, like the entire time I've been sort of in and around elite universities over the last 9 years, I think I've only met only one other foster kid. And so it's extremely rare, like, to sort of reach the sort of upper echelons, at least in academia, with that kind of background. And even he, like, his story was, you know, less crazy than mine.
Yeah. Yours is unusually crazy for foster care. And foster care is often like, if you're in foster care, you can often go back to your parents, right? It's usually like, what percentage of foster kids are actually like you, or like their parents are just completely not in the picture? Is that relatively rare?
So I don't know the actual figure, but it's rare. Usually, if not the parent, then someone from the family of origin can, you know, supply care for the kid. You know, an aunt or a grandmother or, someone in the family can usually... Yeah, like the kids who remain in the system and are either adopted or age out, like that's pretty uncommon. And my story was weird too because, like, you know, there was no family of origin available. You know, like, no one knew who my father was, and then my mother was not in the country, and so it was like, you know, I was in the foster care system for all this time for really no reason. I should have been put up for adoption much sooner. From there I got like an interesting sort of, you know, at the time I wasn't aware of this, but, you know, I got like this front row seat into like the sort of fragmenting families in like working class, lower middle class neighborhoods in the country. Like I grew up in like, you know, what you would call sort of working class or like prole blue collar part of California. And, it was, you know, at that point in the 90s, you know, there was still an ideal to get married and to have intact families, but it was just so hard for people to actually do that. And so I saw all around me these kind of, you know, these very you know, broken and chaotic situations. Even after I'd left the foster care system, you know, I was sort of still seeing it, which I guess is in another way sort of makes this story interesting, right? Is because, you know, like in the book, I'm adopted, I'm with this family, and then there's a divorce. And then I start describing the families of everyone else in Red Bluff, California. And everyone is raised by single moms or by a grandmother or by some kind of alternate sort of family arrangement. And, you know, this is like something I think that escapes people's notice, you know, college educated, sort of upwardly mobile people, that they don't understand that, like, families are like completely messed up now, outside of that, part of the country.
Yeah. Are you, so do you, like stay, do you stay in contact with a lot of the people you grew up with, like your friends, people in foster care? Do they still, I mean, are they like amazed by your success?
I don't really, so I have a couple of, so the two brothers that I lived with in high school, I stay in touch with them. Yeah, it's weird. It's like one of those things where I don't talk about my professional success unless they bring it up and they think it's pretty cool. You know, it's like one of those things where like the YouTube algorithm will show them me on a podcast or something and they'll message me and say, hey, check this out. I, you know, this popped up, and that's like a cool thing for them. But, you know, I don't really dwell on it, and we don't really, you know, it's more like we reminisce, we talk about the old days, we talk about, you know, remember when this happened, or, you know, I'll ask them about their family, personal stuff, movies, pop culture. But, you know, because it's sad, like, I don't want to, like, make it seem like I'm bragging or boasting, because their lives aren't actually going that well. You know, they're just, like, professionally, like, even by their own standard, I'm not, like, judging them from this position of, oh, I'm so much better than them. Like, even if you ask them, do you think your life is going well? I think they would say, like, you know, not really. And so, but yeah, I try to stay in touch with them. It gets harder as time goes on. You know, the period between phone calls and stuff, like, it gets longer each time, but I still try to, you know, shoot them a message every once in a while and check in. And it's like a good way to just, like, I don't know, just like keep a finger on the pulse of, like, you know, this is what my life could have been like.
Did you, you know, so yeah, I mean, I have not as extreme as you, but I have friends who, like, didn't go to college or whatever that I would stay in contact with for a while, though I haven't talked to them in a while, but I did for much of my adult life. Did you notice them becoming, like, changing their political views? Because they were apolitical when I knew them, and now they're, like, they all worship Trump. Have you observed something similar?
Yeah, worship might be too strong. Like, if politics comes up, like, yeah, are they all Trump supporters? Yeah, at least the two brothers are. One more so than the other, but, like, they're both in support of Trump. They're not, like, you know, waving the MAGA flag, and, like, they don't have the red hat or anything. But, like, yeah, they both, but it, which is, like, exactly what you would expect, right? Like, non-college educated, sort of working class, young male. Like, that's, like, you know, that's, like, prime Trump demo. So yeah, like, in high school, you know, like, this was the 2000s. We weren't really, no one cared about politics. It was, like, uncool to care about politics at that point. And then, yeah, everyone sort of drifted by default, I think, into this, you know, you're not, you know, if you're anti-woke and you're, you know, you just sort of fall into the Trump camp, by default.
Yeah. That was, I mean, that's just, it's cool that we're old enough to remember the transition from the culture that didn't care about politics at all to the one where everyone was political, and you could always sort of, I think you could have probably predicted which people would become Trumpist. I mean, I think Trump is part of the reason why it'd be on the left end, on, like, you know, whatever the right, whatever these people are, right? It's just an entertainment show for them, and people are just, you know, compelled by it, or, you know, repulsed by him, or whatever.
Yeah. Well, what I find interesting, like, when I talk to, like, blue collar Trump voters, like, it is, like, I think it's more heterogeneous, like, the attitudes toward Trump than people think. Like, I think, like, you know, like, educated people, they think, like, of Trump's base is just, like, a bunch of rabid morons, and, like, those people exist. But, like, I've been in rooms where these guys are talking, and there is, like, you know, debates and discussions around, like, you know, how much should Trump just focus on governing versus, like, you know, screwing around on Truth Social or Twitter or whatever, and, like, you know, insulting his enemies openly and being a little bit of a clown. And some of it is a generational thing, like blue collar guys, like, I would say, like, over age 40, over age 50, like, they don't actually like that part of Trump. Like, they just want Trump to, like, govern and not be a crazy person. And then, like, under 30 Trump voters, you know, they like, you know, they're shit posters, right? Like, they like this stuff. But it is, like, you know, even among, like, my high school friends, you know, there, especially in 2016, I remember, they were initially surprisingly kind of disgusted by Trump. And then, like, you know, eventually I think they just got so provoked or radicalized by the far left. And they eventually just grew to accept Trump and, you know, and then started to like him.
Yeah. The man has an amazing sort of cultural sort of gravity that just sort of distorts everything. And these people have never cared about politics. They sort of became, you know, they sort of became into it. When did you start, I get a little bit of a sense of this book, when did you start really becoming skeptical of, like, sort of, I guess, liberal elite consensus? You talk about, I mean, Yale, you say, oh, they used to think this, and I thought this was weird, and I thought that was, but, like, were you thinking, like, in these terms of cultural elites or whatever in, like, high school or the military? I mean, like, when did it really just start at Yale?
Yeah, probably earlier than that, actually. I mean, I was not, like, you know, I wasn't like an intellectual person. I read books and, you know, I mentioned some of the books and some of the interests that I had when I was a teenager. And, but I wasn't really thinking in those kind of like broad political terms. You know, when I was a kid, we didn't have cable. Like, we couldn't afford cable. So I wasn't watching like Jon Stewart or Colbert or any of that. Like, you know, we didn't have subscriptions to news. Like, we had a subscription to Red Bluff Daily News, which was like the local paper, which is like, oh, the mill's closing down or whatever, like that kind of stuff. But it wasn't sophisticated political commentary. That wasn't like a part of our, you know, our dinner table conversation. Although I do remember we would sometimes, as like a family, like when my mom was dating this woman, Shelley, and they were living together, I remember sometimes we would watch The Apprentice. So Trump did come up at the dinner table discussions, but not for political reasons. So it was probably around 2012, actually. Somehow, So I remember in 2008. I'll just tell this aside. I was at work when the election results came in 2008, and they called it for Obama pretty early. And my first sergeant, I was sitting with him, and he looked me right in the eye, and he was like, "It's all going to go to shit now, Henderson. It's all going to go to shit." he's basically like we just elected our first socialist president, and I was like, I was 18 years old with that. I was like, I didn't even know what he was talking about. I didn't really know I kind of had some vague inkling what socialism was, but like, I don't know. I didn't care. Like, the election was not interesting to me. By 2012, I did start to develop like a little bit of a sense of like politics, and I don't know. I would read things online, and you know, I started to read articles, and like, I didn't really have a strong opinion one way or the other over who would win the election, but I do have, like, I couldn't name any specific quotes or policies, but for whatever reason, I did feel myself sort of drifting more toward Romney than Obama. And I don't know why. I don't know why that was. Probably something I'd heard or something I'd read. Maybe something you do with sort of a more like free market oriented policies, something like that, just naturally appealed to me. I also got like the sort of soundbite from Obama that "you didn't build that" speech. I remember that irritated me. And do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
You didn't build that thing. Yeah. I remember, like, I probably only heard like a clip of that on whatever, like on a YouTube video or something. And I saw that and I'm like, that sounds stupid. But yeah, it wasn't really until Yale where I started to like actually think more politically, started to read more and started to reflect on my own views and, you know, realize like probably, you know, 10 years before that or 15 years before that, it's possible I could have been like a blue dog Democrat or something. Like, my mom growing up, like they were working class Democrats, and there was something about that that appealed to me, sort of sticking up for the working man, like that sort of old school kind of liberalism appealed to me. But by 2016, like, I was seeing like this was the future of the Democrat Party, and I was like, this looks insane. So by default, I sort of slipped on over to the center right, and just sort of stuck with that.
Yeah. How much of a culture shock, besides like the political or social views, was it to run into these kids at Yale? Because I really wasn't exposed to many upper class people until really law school, until pretty late. And law schools, Chicago law school is probably not as, I don't know, culturally, it's not certainly not as culturally liberal as probably Yale undergrads. What was just your impression of these people aside from their like political or social views, like how they conducted themselves and how they lived their lives?
I try to be fair in the book when I write about them, especially my first impressions, and they were all like, I mean, all is too strong, but generally speaking, they were, you know, remarkably bright and ambitious and talented, and you know, like they were just like clearly like, you know, and many of them had been sort of groomed and trained their whole lives to go to a school like Yale. You know, they went to private boarding schools and, you know, they were just sort of cultured and interesting young people. And and I found that interesting and appealing about them to speak with them about like non-political issues, about academics or about intellectual topics. They were just really impressive in that way. And Yeah, like anytime it veered into like sort of contemporary political topics, they seemed to suddenly become dumber. But when it came to like, you know, art or literature or commentary or anything else, they were just sort of more engaged and clearly had sort of more mental horsepower than so many other people that I had interacted with. And, you know, and I really enjoyed that, sort of being in that kind of environment, right? Because I'd spent basically my entire life to that point being sort of relatively starved of intellectual stimulation. When I was in the Air Force, I met people who were smart, but like, you know, like they weren't, they were there, but they were, you had to find them. And I found myself sort of befriending these people. Like one of my best friends when I was, in the Air Force was this guy. He was an Army lieutenant. He was an officer who had went to Columbia. And he became one of my good friends. And at the time, you know, it's funny, like at the time, I didn't even know that Columbia was special. Like, I remember he offhandedly mentioned that Columbia was an Ivy League school. And I was like, oh, it is? Like, I didn't even know. I thought Ivy League was like Harvard or Yale or something. But like, that was the, you know, I found those people by accident or just through speaking with people and seeing who I connected with. But by the time I got to Yale, it was like almost everyone I spoke to, I felt like I could connect with them on an intellectual level, which was really nice.
Yeah. Did you end up making a lot of friends that you've kept in touch with over the years or like, you know, who are just like sort of normie Yale graduates in other ways?
I'm still friends with them. I'm in the group chats and the, you know, I stay in touch and hang out and I mean, it's, yeah, unsurprisingly, you know, this is common for Yale grads. They're mostly clustered in and around New York City. And so, you know, when I go to New York for work or for book events and stuff, yeah, of course I'll hang out with them and, yeah, and they've landed in the kinds of jobs you would expect for Yale grads. And this is something else that was surprising to me is like, you know, these kids are so smart and so talented. And yeah, they sort of fall into the same kinds of jobs of tech and finance and consulting. And I understand why. I mean, it's extremely lucrative and prestigious and all those things. But I did think that, you know, I guess I was just surprised at the sort of risk aversion. You know, because if you come from money and you're a smart person, you know, you can do anything you want. That was kind of my perspective. And you're going to sort of follow this cookie cutter path. But to their credit, I did see a lot of people follow that path initially and then pivot towards something that they actually did end up enjoying more. And if I were 22 years old, you know, I probably would have followed that path too. So it's not like I'm judging them or anything like that.
Yeah, this kind of entrepreneurship quality, this, because you meet people, you've met people now who've started businesses and, you know, especially West Coast, Silicon Valley people who just start something on their own or with friends. And yeah, it's a completely different kind of person from the person who just can't imagine anything beyond, you know, funnel, go to the good high school, go to the good college, then go to the, you know, acceptable, you know, consult to the big name consulting firm or eventually end up at the big law firm or whatever. It really is just like a very deep difference in personality types. Did some of them like go into like less paid profession, like journalists? Like how common is like journalists or like?
I mean, I knew like Aaron Sabarium. You know, I knew he wrote for the Yale Daily News and he was a, you know, even back then in undergrad, he was kind of a provocative dude. I think, you know, he wrote this piece that got quite a bit of attention, something about like, you know, against hookup culture or something like that, which I think today would be less controversial, but, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, that was still kind of an edgy stance. Because that was pre-Me Too when he wrote that. And so, you know, hookup culture was like the default and how could you possibly be against it? But, you know, so yeah, I knew some people who did go that sort of journalism route. But the kinds of people that I liked tended to go more into like finance or tech or like, you know, because you're less ideological, I think, right? Like if you're chasing money, you're just like a normal person. Whereas if you pursue journalism or academia, you usually have some sort of ideological chip on your shoulder. And I mean, I made friends who, you know, went into journalism and academia too, but my like close friends tended to be more interested in making money.
Yeah. I'm a little bit different. I mean, I think I tend to get along with better with someone who probably has some kind of ideological or sort of intellectual interest.
Okay.
As like a friend, like just to like, I don't know, run into them. Like, it's not like I wouldn't get along with them or something, but like, if I'm going to spend extended time with someone, like usually there, for me, there sort of needs to be sort of an intellectual life there. Yeah. You seem to be more a man of the people.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, like my friends who I from college who I talk to, like they are sort of broadly, I mean, they're smart anyway, just because like people who tend to go to these schools tend to be smart, and they tend to like sort of broadly be on the right. And they are capable of intellectual conversation, but like, yeah, they're not, it doesn't propel them. It's not like, you know, their main interest is sort of making money, being successful and climbing up and doing well for themselves, and not so much, you know, like trying to, sort of advance a worldview or a policy or something like that. So I think that's, you know, that's probably right that I am less interested in those things.
Yeah. You mentioned you were in the Air Force. I almost thought it was the Army. It was the Air Force?
No, I was in the Air Force. Just an accident. My history teacher, he was in the Air Force, and he recommended it to me. And my friend's dad, who I lived with my senior year of high school, was in the Air Force. It was just a coincidence that they happened to both be in the Air Force and suggest it. So I just went that route. And
Did you learn? Did you didn't fly planes, did you?
No. This is it's a common. You know, basically only 4% of people in the Air Force are pilots, and 96% are essentially sort of, you know, other jobs, support, technicians, radar operators, you know, whatever, like burger flippers, you know, everything else that makes up the enlisted side. I was a technician.
And so did you didn't go overseas, did you? I mean, you went to Germany, I know, but you didn't go to one of the war zones, did you?
No. Well, I went to Al Udeid in Qatar, and I went to Manas Air Base in Kyrgyzstan, and I spent one night in Kandahar in Afghanistan, just sort of on my way. So from Germany to Kyrgyzstan, I spent one night in Afghanistan. Air Force, you don't really, unless you're like in TACP or pararescue, you don't really see combat, right? Like it's not like the Army or the Marines. And so I would not like, you know, I didn't see combat, but I would see the, the sort of the aftermath of it where, you know, I was repairing planes in Al Udeid. And so the planes from Iraq or Afghanistan would stop over in Al Udeid. And so they'd have like the medevac or like these planes would land, and I would see these guys, they just like had their limbs blown off by an IED or something like that. And so I would see them, or I would see the planes land, and they would be full of caskets draped in American flags. And so it was like, I was sort of like one degree removed from all of that was happening. Most people in the Air Force don't actually see combat.
Yeah. What was Kyrgyzstan like? That's a pretty, isolated place.
Yeah, it was remote, and it was, kind of arid and dry and sandy, and, it was also, kind of makeshift. I don't even know if we still have that base or if we're still affiliated anymore, because that, when was I there? I think I was there in, like, 2012 or 2013. We had like other military services there too. So yeah, there were Australians and Dutch, and these are sort of like NATO aligned bases. So, you know, you see the Canadians. It was, at the time, how did I get over there? I flew in a C-130. This was one of these sort of older Air Force jets, super loud. He had to wear like two layers of hearing protection. Extremely uncomfortable, and I don't know. It was I'm glad I had that experience. You know, being young and sort of being having lived through that. But in hindsight, it was just like, I don't know. It sucks like having every aspect of your life I woke up that morning. It's like 6 a.m. I didn't get to work, and they're like, hey, you're going to Kyrgyzstan. I'm like, oh. You know, so like all the plans I had that week, like I was going to, I probably was going to hang out with my girlfriend or something that weekend, and like everything just, out the window. And they didn't tell me how long I was going to be gone for, like that kind of thing. It's, it's what you sign up for, but it's still, you know, it still sucks.
Well, so when you're in some place like Kyrgyzstan, are you allowed to like, can you like go to like bars or like go to the malls or anything? Like, can you explore the culture at all, or you're just hanging out of the airbase?
No, just hanging out. When I was in Al Udeid, we could go into Doha, the city there in Qatar. You had to like, you know, have like a series of like security clearances, and you had to like be with someone of a certain rank. So, and you had to like, travel.
Your officer would like chaperone you. You couldn't go as like an adult. Someone of a rank had to watch over you.
Yeah, because dude, like military guys are stupid, especially like young. Like I think I was like 20 or 20. Like if you get a group of 20-year-olds, like 20-year-olds in general are stupid. But like if you get like a group of 5 20-year-old guys together, go off base, have some beers, like Americans, like dude, they're gonna do stupid things. So you're gonna want like one person of a certain rank. Usually the person is like, you know, at least 30, who's supervising. And so you have to, I think, travel within groups of 4 or 5. And so we did go off base once in Doha, and like I don't know what we did, like had some beer, smoked some hookah, and it was like very, very obvious we were not only Americans, but we were in the military, because we all had that same like short haircut, we're all wearing like kind of like, you know, very generic clothes. And we were like every single like semi-attractive woman that walked by, we would like gawk at them, because you know we hadn't like really been around women in like 4 or 5 months. Quite clearly stood out.
And then Doha, Qatar is one of those places where the attractive foreign women, the natives would be covered up, and the women would be the attractive women would all be foreigners, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All the locals were covered, but they had like a lot of Western women, and surprisingly, I mean, again, this could be just because I hadn't been around women in so long, but I just remember like being shocked at the number of attractive women in that city.
It's probably not just that. I mean, the women who are probably there are probably very well off, and you know, they're probably unusually beautiful and gold diggers, and probably have rich husbands. So yeah, it's probably a place for beautiful women. That's, I mean, what a life. What an interesting life, Rob. Anything surprise you about the reaction from like you know, people to your book? Like, I know it's being very well received, but anything that's, you know, you didn't expect?
Anything I didn't expect. No, I mean, you know, I've been really pleased with how, how things have developed, how, people have connected with it. I guess that was one concern that I had was, you know, early on in the process, I'm like, is anyone really going to like find this story interesting? Are they going to connect with it? Because it is unusual. You know, it's like kind of outside of people's purview. And I've been, actually surprised at the number of readers and people who've emailed me saying that they did connect with it. Even people from sort of perfectly, at least from the outside, you would assume like perfectly ordinary sort of middle class or upper middle class lives, married, intact parents, the whole thing. But they connected with my story because, you know, behind the scenes, like no one ever knew about this about their family, but actually their mom was an alcoholic or whatever. Like they had some sort of secret family shame or something that, you know, traumatized them or upset them or made their lives very difficult. And, you know, they found something in my story to connect with. And so that was actually surprising at first, but I guess in hindsight, maybe not, because I remember reading memoirs of people who had different life stories than me and I found something to connect with. That's been nice too. And also that like, I was worried because my Substack readers are mostly male and memoir readers are mostly female. And so I wondered if I would end up reaching the right audience. Like I thought my male readers would like think, oh, what is this like emotional, you know, memoir, you know, woe is me, you know, kind of story of foster care. Like they're not going to be interested in this. And the women who would typically read a book about a story like that would like, whatever, like they're not going to be interested because whatever, maybe they have assumptions about my politics or something. But ultimately, the book seems to have reached men and women, and both seem to generally find something in the story to connect with. So that's been nice too.
Yeah, that's really cool. So what's next for you, Rob? More Substacking? Get a book planned? What are you going to do after this whole thing's over?
I mean, it's already kind of slowly winding down, which is nice actually. But more Substack essays to write. You know, more. more Twitter, more reviewing Shogun with Richard Hanania.
Oh yeah, we
got and that. Just sort of taking it easy. I'm going to take a little bit of a break. Actually, I'm kind of on like a half break right now from Substack. Eventually, I'll probably call up my agent and figure out if I'm going to do another book or not. But for now, yeah, I just want to concentrate on these essays that I've been thinking about, some more Substacks and some other sort of side projects. I have like these informal conversations with Hollywood producers. They seem sort of tepidly interested in possibly doing something with this book. I'm also speaking with this other guy who wants to do like a podcast series potentially about my book. And so I think like, as you well know, like most people don't read books, but a lot of people will listen to podcasts or watch movies or whatever. And so if I could repackage the story in more accessible ways, I'd be interested in doing something like that too.
Why don't you play? Do you want to play yourself as an adult?
No. Why? If someone's going to play in a movie, wouldn't you want someone like more attractive than yourself? Like you'd want like a hotter version of you, like someone who looks like you, but like better, right? Like that's what I would want.
I don't know. I mean, I would want to be in a movie. I don't know. Like it's like, when else are you going to be in a movie, right? And you could play yourself.
I would cameo in it. Like I would play like, play the uglier friend. I'd play the uglier friend, but I would want the guy who plays me to be, a little bit better looking.
I don't know. You're pretty good looking, Rob. I don't know. I mean, it's fine. I don't know. They usually like, do they just find the best possible looking actor? It's usually they're looking for resemblance, aren't they? So it's
But if you ever watch like biopics, like the person playing the usually more attractive, unless they're playing like someone who's already a celebrity, if they're doing like, if you're having someone play, some famous attractive rock star, but like a regular person or like a, usually want someone better looking, it's a movie.
Try to recreate your life, like act it. Like that would be fun. I don't know. That would be a very unusual sort of surreal experience. It didn't happen like this. And you'd be able to be on the set guide. That's probably why they don't do it. Probably they would have too many opinions and it would be too awkward for the actor,
The way it happens is they just like cut you a check and then they get complete creative control and do whatever they want with it.
Do you feel uncomfortable with that? Like they might do something weird or something you don't like.
I don't know. I think it'd be, I mean, I'd want to know the details, but my inclination is probably like, it's probably fine.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, we'll look forward to the movie or the miniseries or whatever. I really hope that happens. And congratulations on the book, Rob. And until next time.
All right. Thanks, Richard.